So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's March 12th, 2014. And I've been doing a series, as you probably know, about what I think of as the essence of the Four Noble Truths, the second and third truths, the truth of the cause of suffering and the truth of the possibility of ending that cause and suffering with it, which is, for me as a neuropsychologist kind of guy who thinks a lot about evolution, it's a real challenge to imagine how in the world could we actually fulfill the possibility of the third noble truth, given that we've got a brain that's pretty designed to suffer and crave in order to survive and pass on genes that pass on genes. So in that larger context, last week I did a probably overly dense summary of the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness and liberating insight into the impermanent nature of all experiences and much of reality altogether. And hopefully you received the email I sent out in which I pulled together the quotations that I drew upon for that talk. And if you didn't get that email, it means you're not getting emails related to the sitting group. So if you want emails related to the sitting group, just fill out that little sign-up sheet over there, or you can email me and I'll put you on the email list for the sitting group. And I'll never share your email address with anybody. So in that context then, I wanted to zero in on one of the most, for me, relevant findings in neuroscience in terms of sustaining mindfulness, especially a sustained feeling of mindfulness for our experience as a whole. So that's my subject tonight. And you can find out more about this topic if you like by going to my website and going into the slide sets in the multimedia section and going to the section on being and doing. That's the general territory of this topic. Okay. So with that in mind, the research finding basically, I'll do a demo here. You ready for a live demo? Okay. So breath, presence, passing through, breath, nice, breath. Shopping list. Milk. Get milk on the way home. Safeway. Is Safeway still open? Yeah, I think Safeway's open 24 hours. I better get this other stuff too. And oh, money, man, we need more money. Why doesn't my partner make more money? You know, like what? Breath. Being here now. Breath. Okay. Who among us is unfamiliar with that process? Well, to neurologize our experience, very interesting studies show that when we're in that first mode, you know, open awareness, breath, present with experience as a whole, being in the moment, not much sense of self, not worrying about the past, not planning the future, just here with all of it, we activate networks on the sides of the cortex, on the sides of the brain, especially the right side for right-handed people and roughly half of all lefties. It's reversed for the fraction of left-handers who have language more or less on the right side of the brain. Okay? So on the other hand, when we go into shopping list mode or worrying about the past or just going into fantasy like, oh yeah, fantasy, Hawaii, fantasy, or what have you, or we're taking things personally, right? We then activate midline networks of the cortex that overlap with what scientists now call the default networks of the brain, right? That's this territory, the midline networks. Now, if people without training are asked in an MRI to go into a state of sort of open awareness, where they have an awareness of things as a whole, they're able to usually sustain that for about 5 seconds, maybe 10. And then fairly quickly, whoop, shopping list. They're back in their personal reactions to things and taking life personally. Right? On the other hand, after an 8-week course in MBSR, if not sooner, people are increasingly able to stabilize the activation of the lateral networks and just remain hanging out in breath, Body as a whole breathing, breath, body as a whole breathing, breath after breath after breath. So the question then becomes a very practical one. How do we strengthen these lateral networks? Particularly in a context to kind of broaden out the point, and there's more content about this on my website and those slide sets on being and doing. If you think about it, it's not just the distinction between shopping list and breath. It's the distinction between conceptualizing and abstracting and being in concrete moment-to-moment experience. It's the context between being in the future or the past and being in the present. It's the larger frame or context or distinction, really, between taking things quite personally and having very little sense of self. It's the distinction between looking at life from an egocentric, self-referencing point of view versus looking at life from an allocentric, holistic, oneness point of view. Now, to kind of charge up the distinction there, one of the ways that this distinction has been drawn historically is the distinction not so much between shopping list and breath, but between masculine and feminine modes of consciousness. And I'm using those words deliberately, provocatively. All right? Good. Also, the distinction has been drawn historically, not just between shopping list and breath, but between civilized and primitive, or adult and childlike, or superego, ego, and it. So these distinctions are not merely neurological. They've been politicized and used in ways that aren't so good, obviously, historically. And given the fact that neurons that fire together wire together, since much of modern life, certainly conventional schooling, and many aspects of engaged, task-oriented doing, really stimulates the neural networks of the midline mode, the shopping list mode, right? The doing mode, in contrast to the being mode, if you will, of the lateral networks, the more breath, experience as a whole, moment-by-moment mode. Well, since modern life continually stimulates the midline networks, it also strengthens them. And since much of the activations that we're engaging in the midline networks have a negative quality to them, we're worried about various things, or we're irritated about things, we're caught up in our cases about other people, we're kind of in our own mind, looping in our argument with our family members. Well, because of the negativity bias, those activations in the midline networks are especially promoting of structure building, which then becomes a kind of cycle, if not a vicious cycle, in which a predilection or habit of orienting to life from the doing mode, the shopping list mode, engages us in shopping list kinds of activities or cognition or reflection or emotional reactivity, which further stimulates and thus strengthens the neural substrates of that mode. It can feel, I think, on the inside out, as if there's a kind of inner tyranny or hegemony that continually hijacks us. We open out into just peaceful, moment-to-moment presence with life as it is. There you are, you know, on the beach, right? Holding your child in your arms or just cuddling up with your lover, and you're thinking, oh, just blissful, just hanging in the moment, and within a dozen or two dozen seconds, you're off in shopping list mode, or I am, right? It could feel like something's taking over. So how do we reestablish some sense of balance so that we can go into doing mode when it's appropriate, right? We can do skillfully when it's appropriate, but also at will, we can go more out into this being mode, this open awareness mode, you know, breath after breath, experience as a whole mode. That's a very valuable goal. So the question becomes then, what activates, what stimulates these lateral networks? And here, as I was saying, there's some very useful material from neuroscience about this. One of the main ways to stimulate and therefore strengthen neurons that fire together, wire together, those lateral networks of the being mode is gestalt experiencing, sensing things as a whole. Whether it's stepping back and seeing a work of art as a whole, or feeling the sensations of breathing in the torso as a whole, thus my suggestions during the meditation today, or sensing the body as a whole, or stepping back with a kind of panoramic perspective and seeing all of experience as one unified object of attention. However we do that stimulates those lateral networks and has other benefits as well that I'll get into momentarily. In the beginning, for me at least, if you could do this right now, you might notice when you say, okay, be mindful of breathing, right? Different aspects of the physical sensations of breathing kind of pop into the foreground of awareness one after another. It's kind of like stage, like awareness is a stage. There's a spotlight in the center. We're dimly aware of things in the background, but, you know, depending on how you want to play with the metaphor, the spotlight skitters around the stage, or it's stable, but different things pop into the foreground and then leave the foreground. That's the common nature. That's the way it typically is. And you can see that even if you're just going to hang out with the sensations of breathing. You know, different sensations attract attention one after another. A different way about it, though, is to pick a fairly restricted area, like just the torso, and try to expand the spotlight of awareness. So it takes the torso as a whole, as the single object of attention, breath after breath after breath. My personal experience of doing that, it's a practice I've done quite a while now, was in the beginning it was quite challenging. It was weird. I felt I have good steadiness of mind. I was startled by how hard it was in the beginning to sustain that experience of just the torso as a whole. You know, start with something concrete. And it would crumble or become conceptual, right? But then I would regenerate it again and again, and I gradually became comfortable with the sense of the torso as a whole, which then you can use as a building block to including more of the sensations of breathing, like around the throat, the cool going in, the warm going out, or around the upper lip. And that then becomes also your object of attention. The spotlight widens, right? You're stretching the muscle. You're building the muscle of, as it were, the lateral networks. And then you take out to the body as a whole, just abiding as a whole body breathing. Now, I think there's some people who are just naturally able to go there. They're already very right-brained. I don't think it's no accident. Scientists think it's no accident that these lateral networks predominate on the right hemisphere of the brain, which is specialized for gestalt awareness, awareness of things as a whole. That's why the right hemisphere is specialized for imagery processing, visual spatial processing, because images are a whole. The left hemisphere is specialized for sequential processing, one after another. That's why it does language and motor planning, or a lot of motor planning, because language, you know, is sequential. It's sequential sequences of sounds that translate into sequences of meaning, which translate into, you know, language comprehension altogether. I think there's some people, in other words, who are just naturally gifted at going into this holistic awareness. You may be able to skip my kind of intermediate steps, and that's cool. It's fine. But the bottom line is, you know, can you abide as a whole body breathing, and then start, if you can, expand it out to basically have a sense of all of experience known simultaneously, every aspect of your experience. Sounds, the sound streaming, the sensations, the way this shows up typically in meditation with eyes closed are sensations, sounds, and thoughts. And then you can increasingly include what I call the wallpaper of the mind, the kind of background sense of what it's like to live, you know, that aspect of experience. and even can start to include the observing itself, so that increasingly it's mind as a whole, mind taken as a whole, that becomes the single unified object of attention. That's a challenge, to go that far out. That's deep, that's pretty thorough concentration. And at that point, you're edging into what's known as the fifth jhana factor, singleness of mind, or in Pali, ekagata. So for some people, this might be familiar material. For other people, really way out there. So I'll kind of try to bring it in. You may recall or know already that in the Eightfold Path the Buddha laid out, one of the eight elements is what's called right concentration. Right concentration is these four non-ordinary states of awareness. So the Buddha's putting it right out front. You know, a major aspect of his path are states of absorption, meditative, contemplative absorption, that do not feel like you're in Kansas any longer. You know, they're non-ordinary states. They're attainable, though. He wouldn't just make it one of the eight elements, one-eighth of the Noble Eightfold Path, in some way of meaning that, consists of these deep, different, very trippy, non-ordinary states of awareness. Okay? One of the five, so there are five factors that support these states of awareness traditionally. And these five factors, even if we can't, typically most people, me included, go into or have some access to these jhanas in a retreat environment. There's some unusual or uncommon individuals who can access them fairly readily. You know, they have that kind of background. They can just kind of go there. You know, that's pretty easy, accessible to them. Most people, me included, need to sustain some pretty steady retreat practice to get to that tipping point. We can have intimations of these jhanas. The intimations are not the jhanas themselves. They're good intimations. They're important to value them. We might have a flash of it, but it's not stable yet. Okay, typically, these jhana experiences stabilize when people are in retreat. And at some point, I'm going to focus on what I know of about jhana practice and concentration practice, including what could be happening in the brain about it. That said, the five traditional factors of the jhanas are very accessible in home practice. And they really give us a kind of roadmap for practice that's powerful. And again, in the Buddhist frame, for what it's worth, one of the three pillars of practice, one of the three fundamental elements of the path of liberation is called samadhi, or concentration, is training the mind to be able to go into these fairly deep states. It's not that, you know, there are only two major pillars of practice, virtue and wisdom. You know, lots of times Buddhism is presented as just two pillars of practice, be nice and understand things, right? Well, there's this other element, which is where you really train the mind to go into these deep states of clarity. Okay. So it matters to work on these five jhana factors. What are these factors? Applying your attention. That's pretty straightforward. Breath, beginning of the inhalation. Applying to the beginning of the exhalation. Applying attention. Or applying attention to the feeling of the breath in the whole torso, if it crumbles. Or once you go into shopping list mode, whoop, reapplying attention to the breath. Second jhana factor, sustaining attention, staying with it. That's where a lot of practice lives. Okay. Third jhana factor, bliss. Bliss in the body, a kind of opening to the rushes that can come through you as you concentrate. Fourth jhana factor, joy. Typically on a spectrum from happiness to contentment to tranquility. The bliss factor may not be that accessible, again, especially in everyday practice, but the joy factor is, especially that sense of happiness or contentment or tranquility. And then the fifth jhana factor is, like I said, unification of consciousness, singleness of mind. So one of the bonus benefits of doing this training yourself in being able to tune in to the sensations of breathing as a whole in like one area of the body, and then extending that out to the whole body, then extending that to all the sensations in the body, and then extending that to experience as a whole. One of the benefits of that practice is it makes you more accessible to unification of consciousness, singleness of mind, which is one of the important jhana factors, the fifth one. Okay. And then to finish up, to make a final point about this, and I want to see what you think about all this, is if you think about it, the more that we can stabilize a wide focus, the more we're able to see situations as a whole and not get so trapped in some part of them. That's useful in everyday life. Also, the more that we tend to see things as a whole, the more we see the big picture, and naturally, we tend to feel less vulnerable and defended and braced and and also we tend to not be so personally preoccupied. We tend to take things less personally, which is great right there. Also, to bring it back to the truths of craving, you can see in your own mind that whenever there's craving, right, there's the craving part, and then there's the object of the craving part. It's two parts, right? There's this sense that the craving feeling, the wanting, right, or going to war with it feeling, those aspects of craving, feels like it's a part of the psyche. And it's targeting some other thing, right? Some cookie it wants or some splinter it wants to go away, whatever. The more we open out into this sense of experience as a whole, the less sense there is of parts. There's more a sense of experience or mind, including awareness, as a whole. And there's a natural undoing of craving, because there's less and less basis for one part to crave another part in your own experiencing. And that's a really neat exploration to engage. I think to finish, that as I've been reflecting lately, a lot about modern technical life, modern culture, has a lot of good features, right? Refrigeration, ibuprofen, what have you, okay? YouTube. But so much of modern life in terms of training the brain relentlessly, hundreds of times a day, in activities that are 10 to 100 seconds long, generally, it trains the brain in this very narrow part focus, one part dealing with another part. And I think about how our ancestors evolved, or most people actually lived until roughly 150 years ago, the Industrial Revolution, out in the country, let alone, until only about 10,000 years ago, living as hunter-gatherers, way out. In that way of life, as many people write about and we experience often today when we go out into that, we go camping or something, or we just kind of hang out in the woods for a while, that naturally takes us out into the whole, right? I think that's our human endowment. That's our nature. Our nature is to have many moments where we're just kind of hanging in gestalt awareness, partly because that's how to stay alive in the wild, that kind of 360-degree awareness, picking up sounds from behind, sights from the front, and all the rest of that, tuning into the body simultaneously. There's a lot about modern life with this fixation on parts, engaging other parts, which involves this tyranny of the midline networks, that's completely abnormal. It's not normal, it's not good for us. It's the new normal, which really means the primal abnormal. So doing practice, at least a few minutes a day, whether it's informal practice or just kind of in everyday life, where we deliberately push out the spotlight of attention, we retrain it, we reclaim it's our nature to see the whole. Doing that kind of practice is an act of kind of cultural disobedience in a sense. It's a stand for personal freedom and autonomy. And that's accessible to us every day, just hanging out, stuck in traffic, in a meeting, kicking it with the in-laws, or just sitting on the cushion, feeling the breath in the torso as a whole, and then widening the spotlight further. It's one of the most practical things I've gleaned, you know, from the neuroderma intersection. Mm-hmm. Great. Comments or questions? Great. That's a part. Good. So you see where this is going. It's great.
I had, you know, in order to get a new one, I had to send that one there to, you know, this time element that was happening without a printer. And yeah, it was like my life stopped. So anyhow, so finally, you know, the box came with the printer. Yeah. And I'm not good at this stuff, but I had nowhere to go, so I said, okay, so neat and orderly. My house was a mess. I have all these projects that I'm not getting to, you know, and then on top of it, my printer breaks. You know, and all of a sudden, in the middle of all this, really, I wanted to just scream, and all of a sudden, I saw the big picture. I mean, I gotta tell you, it almost makes me cry. I'm so grateful to you for bringing this neuroscience thing into my life, because it gives me the basic reason why we should be happy.
Finally, a good reason to be happy. Great, thank you.
Yeah.
That's super, appreciate it. How about other people, including how to do it? Yeah, Tom.
Well, I'm remembering the guest speaker you arranged for a couple, 2 or 3 years ago. They were with us about 3 weeks. They were.
Oh, man and a woman, Tina and Stephen?
Yes.
Yeah, that's who it was, about concentration. Yeah.
I was very much taken by the whole, that was my really introduction to the jhana states. But, you know, the whole idea is out here. And I'm just going to ask you, how can I do this at work? I mean, do I have to go to a retreat? And if I have to go to a retreat, then that's really only an occasional accessibility. So can you speak to your experience on that?
If I get you right, Tom, if you're asking, do I think people can do jhana practice training in a typical work environment? I don't think so. I think if I can imagine, hypothetically, some super-duper meditator who maybe is able to do that, maybe with some aerosol LSD in the air. I don't know. Joking. Don't you know? Joking. Anyway. now, but you can do this thing, though, of, you know, the whole. A couple tricks. One is, lift your eyes above the midline. There are these networks, and I did a different talk about it. I may redo it again because it's so far out. They're networks that are very egocentric, and they particularly are stimulated when we bring the focus close, because that's where friend and foe really operated in our ancestral history. Whereas if you look up, you know, further out, that immediately draws you out into more of a gestalt perspective, right? It's a little trick. And especially if you go out to the horizon line, and you can even just notice it in your feeling. You can just play around with it right here. You bring your eyes down. Unless you're really working the kind of super peaceful, unfocused gaze, you know, a couple of meters in front of you, it tends to be like, how's this relate to me? How's this relate to me? How's this relate to me? Bingo, you're in shopping list, self-referential, midline network mode. But you can just start playing it. You just move your eyes, your gaze out, or you start opening out into the peripheral vision. And especially you go out to the horizon line or beyond, you're pretty far out. And I think there's no accident why many, many times people's moment of awakening, bingo, their eyes were lifted up, like to the morning star, or the three wise men, what have you, in the tale of the birth of Jesus. You know, there's something about that. Anyway, so how I do that myself is you can play with it around like sound as a whole, all the sounds at once taken as a whole, rather than attention skittering from this sound to that sound to this sound to that sound. Or you just kind of feel the room as a whole. Tibetan practice, that's a good one too, is to, you could do it right now in this room, get a feeling of the volume of the room. It's like a volume of air, you know? We tend to focus on parts of it, walls, corners, you know, things, but instead, let the sense of space or this volume of air be your object of attention. As soon as you do that, whoop. I like it, you know, partly for me, you know, there might be some shared, you know, rapport around this one. I don't want the man to run my life, right? And there we are in meetings, one thing or another, and the whole corporate agenda, we're bombarded by media as well, trying to get us to attend to this part, trying to hook some part of us by some part of the world, and then extract something from us as a result. And so for me a lot, you know, I kind of go sometimes to, you know, you may have my body, but you don't get my mind. And in my mind, there's an inner freedom where I'm continually regenerating my focus for the whole. Another way to do it too is, in a meeting, is the dynamics between different people. That's a very relational way to do it. You know, we tend to zero in on there's just you, me, or you, them, but to feel it more as like there's the pack, where the primate band sitting around the table talking about the quarterly report, or whatever it is, right? But really, you know, it's like there's a band here. There are vibes, there are alliances, there's alpha, there's beta, top dog, underdog, you know? Who's faking like an underdog to get it on with the top dog's mate, you know? Whatever, you know, like all this stuff's going on. You feel the whole, that also draws your attention out. And then, you know, right? You can do it like in gossip girl mode, or you can kind of, wow, there's all this energy in a sense, or dynamic, or skittering of attentiveness. That's another way into it. So I don't know if that would take you into the jhanas, but I think we're supporting those factors so that we're more and more able to drop into it. And it's, again, so accessible. Yeah, great.
Rick, thank you so much for this talk. It's been amazingly clear, and I love it. It's a little frustrating sometimes listening to, you know, the conflict we all feel between the shopping mode, all the details and all the buttons you have to push every day.
Yeah.
Somebody that I was wrong, it's yeah. Like this huge weight just gets lifted, and I get that
that's
perspective
great.
Of looking at something really broadly, and I feel light. So that's my contribution to
wow.
Sort of feeling, hearing
yeah.
What you're saying in a very practical way.
Shervin, I think that's so, that really appreciate you saying that. I think I saw this wave of, in my gestalt awareness of the room, you know, this wave of like agreement with you. Yeah, that. Forgiveness or sharing, yeah, from the heart. Great, thank you. Great. Anybody else? Comments, questions? Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference between the concentration practice and the mindfulness meditation?
Right. So, what's the difference between absorption practice and more mindfulness practice? Right. Couple things. So, concentration practice where you're really attempting to become absorbed in something. So it has a lot of stability. is a kind of mindfulness. In other words, we need to be mindful of what our mind is doing. Are we in the breath or whatever we're concentrating on, or are we far away? My preference, and I think sometimes other people do too, they use a distinction between focused attention and open awareness. Focused attention is a very straightforward kind of meditation where you pick some object and you're into becoming really one with it. So that as it develops for you, and this was the Buddha's path, it was a known yogic practice of his time, you become deeply absorbed, increasingly effortlessly absorbed in the object of attention, and the applying of attention tends to fall away, and you're just there, and you can get to a place where you're so in the object of attention that it's hard to get out of your chair. You're like, in. And classically, if you look at the sequence of the Buddha's awakening, or very often his description when he says, okay, you want to go all the way or you want to have liberating insight, this is more or less the sequence. He takes people through the jhanas. And then there's some profound insight into impermanence and the allness of everything, and boom, you're changed. And so, you know, there is this emphasis on concentration as a factor of insight. Right? Some teachers, and there's some controversy in the field, and I think, frankly, both are right. Some teachers say that if you're in a certain kind of absorption state, you can't think in that state at all. You can't have insight. But the state is so powerful that when you come out of it, in the coming out, boom, that's when the insight hits you. So it was a condition of that insight, but the insight didn't happen in the absorption. Personally, and you know, Anallio and other people like that critique that view because that's not how the Buddha described it. But that said, that's just a detail in terms of some teaching people have had. I think the practical takeaway, honestly, is that both are valuable. And training your attention and really playing around with dropping deeply into some object of attention is a very interesting exploration. For me, it's when my own meditation really took off. 15-ish years ago, maybe. I don't know. Probably that far back. And because honestly, I was kind of lollygagging around. You ever know that kind of meditation? Sort of sit down, space out, be peaceful every so often. Oh, yeah. You know? And the nice thing about concentration practice, just you could do it very simply. Pick a sensation like around the breathing at the upper lip or in the torso altogether, or the feeling of cool going in, warm going out, whatever it is, or a loving kindness feeling, or if you're very relationally inclined, some people are more, going with compassion practice or love as an object of attention, whatever it is, and then your practice is super simple. You don't need to think about a lot of technique. You're either in the experience and sustaining that experience, or you're somewhere else. And as soon as you notice you're somewhere else, whoop, you come back. That's powerful. And then on the basis of that, I think people, once you establish that kind of steadiness of mind, here's how I'd sum it up. It's like you need to establish that trunk of the tree. Otherwise, you're screwed. You know, where are you? You're just, right? The mind's all over the place. Got to establish that trunk of the tree. But from that point, there's kind of a fork, depending on what your nature is or what you're working with these days. One fork is to go further into absorption. And as a technical detail, since I'm talking a little concentration here, a very useful thing was told to me by a key teacher for me, Christina Feldman, which is you might start out with focusing on something like the sensations of breathing. That's a common focus of attention. But then what starts to happen is you're dropping into a lot of tranquility, or you might even start feeling a kind of bliss, or just awash in love. It's okay to shift your object of attention from the one you started with, like the sensations of breathing at the upper lip, what have you, to tranquility as your object of attention, or bliss, or love, what have you. See that shift? And that can really deepen it there too. So that's kind of one fork based on this trunk of steadiness of mind. It's gradually cultivated and maybe even really cultivated in an episode. So cultivated over time and also cultivated within an episode of practice. Or alternately, once steadiness of mind is established, and this is, I think, quite common, including in this setting, you know, a person might choose to, okay, now on the basis of the steadiness of mind, I'm really going to go wide open into open awareness practice that has a real stability to it now, rather than, you know, being able to sustain it for only a few seconds at a time. And then we're more and more in this kind of choiceless awareness where, you know, we're just being with what's arising. I think in actual practice, you know, that latter mode of open awareness, if you take all of experience as a whole as your object of attention, you're kind of doing both. You're becoming absorbed in all experience. You're becoming absorbed in mind as a whole, as it were, while being absorbed in it very, very steadily. So then you have this kind of meeting, in a sense, a focused attention, open awareness practice. But I don't know, I find just to sum up and wrap up that this way of thinking about it, established steadiness of mind. My meditation, I had been meditating for about 20 years, easily, before I really tuned into concentration practice. And I think, frankly, my meditation, I don't know if, see if it's true for you, was kind of flabby and wobbly, and it wasn't that productive, fruitful. It was nice, it was better than the alternative, but it just didn't have the oomph, you know? So you might really consider where you are with steadiness of mind and whether doing more steadiness of mind training would really help you. And in everyday life, where we really can't lock attention onto the sensations of breathing, you can really play around with this open awareness practice in which you're aware of your whole experience all at once. Better leave it at that. You know, and I don't mean to get esoteric about it. The point of the Buddha, and my point, is this is within reach, right? We can see what it's like to stay with an inhalation from beginning to end. We can explore what it's like to feel all the sensations in the torso at once as a single object of awareness or content of mind, right? We play around with that. And we can see what happens in workplace environments where we have a sense of things as a whole and then carrying that with us, right? Or we can see what it feels like, as Shervin said, to just really, you know, speak from our heart with someone or forgive somebody. Okay. Great. How about we sit for a minute, then we'll wrap it up. And of course, you know what the Dalai Lama said to the hot dog vendor. Make me one with everything. See you next week.
Even sauerkraut, yes.